And welcome back to Topical Currents. Very good to have you with us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper recovering from a severe back injury, and we do hope to have him back with us very soon. Well, today we look at chelation therapy. It has a long history of being used to treat a variety of ailments and diseases, but the results of a recent study could alter how cardiac patients are treated in the future and potentially save thousands of lives. So what happens when data shakes a doctor's belief? Well, we'll find out. Joining us now is the study chair of the trial to assess chelation therapy, Dr. Gervasio Lamas. Dr. Lamas is the chairman of medicine and chief of the Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center. And he's with us in the studio. We welcome you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Lamas, you're a Harvard-trained conventional cardiologist. And you were a disbeliever in chelation therapy. You thought it was junk science, in your own words. So let's begin with a little of your background and your education, if we could.
Well, I'm really a Miami story. I came from Cuba when I was 8 and lived in Miami till I was 18, graduated from Ransom School for Boys, Harvard College, NYU Medical School, and then back to the Harvard system for medical and postgraduate training, and stayed up there as faculty at Harvard Medical School for 9 years, then came to Miami in 93 as chief of cardiology at Sinai, where I found really a very supportive research environment that allowed me to have some out-of-the-box ideas.
So, okay, do you want to talk about other ideas that you had or before
no.
we get to the chelation?
No, this
no,
one
let's
is,
stay with it.
This
okay.
one is farther out of the box than anything else that I've done.
Okay, why were you and so many other medical practitioners, for that matter, a disbeliever in chelation therapy?
Well, you know, looking back, it's really there's a certain element of crowd mentality. As conventional practitioners, we tend to be suspicious of alternative medicine. It hasn't been tested. In many ways, it's expensive, unproven. And so we do an us versus them kind of thing and say, well, listen, that's just not very good. Chelation in particular had a really bad name because occasionally patients would be hurt by it if it was misadministered, and it was expensive. And so I became curious about it because throughout my entire career, patients sporadically would ask or would tell me that they were getting chelation therapy. And I always gave the same answer. Listen, this is, as best as I can tell, it's junk. It's expensive. It might be dangerous. Take the medicines that I'm prescribing and lose all these crazy ideas.
Well, let me ask you, now you say patients were coming to you who were taking chelation therapy.
Oh, yes.
Why were they coming to you while they were getting that?
They would come to me, and I started out life as an interventional cardiologist. So I was doing catheterizations,
okay.
and I was implanting pacemakers and so on. So the most conventional of the conventional cardiologists.
Yes.
And so they, you know, as part of the history, you say, well, what else are you doing? What medicines are you on? I said, well, I did 20 chelation infusions. And, you know, I would just roll my eyes.
Okay. Well, you know, before we launch into the study, the findings and all this, let's define chelation. What is it?
Right. That's a great starting point. The chelation is really a chemical process in which a molecule that has some negative charges, it's sort of like a baseball mitt, but it has negative charges. So it's like a magnet shaped like a baseball mitt. And that gets infused, and then positively charged molecules, or atoms really, ions, they pop in there, the mitt closes, and then now your body can excrete these. And many of these are metals. Metals are positively charged when they're in the body. And so if you get lead poisoning, if you're a little kid, you eat lead paint, and you have lead poisoning, you will receive calcium EDTA. In order to get the lead chelated and allow your body to excrete it. The root of chelation is from a Greek word for claw, and that's really what it does. It grabs it like with a claw and then allows you to excrete it.
While we're on it, why don't we do a little history of its prior use, when it came into practice? I mean, you say now if a child gets lead poisoning, they'll use it. But it has a longer history than that. And how was its efficacy when it was being used?
Well, this chelation therapy really started, and the compound that we're talking about, which is EDTA, it has a long name, but it's just easier to refer to it as EDTA, was developed in the 1930s with a view towards detoxifying some of these chemical warfare agents that were arsenic-based, because it could drag arsenic out of the body. And then they figured out that it also was good for pulling out lead. And serendipitously, some individuals who also had heart disease but had high lead levels noticed that their chest pains were getting a little bit better. In addition, in the 50s, you have to remember, there's no medicines to treat cholesterol. There's no aspirin for coronary disease. It's pretty primitive then. And all the coronary artery disease was so severe that it was heavily calcified. And the idea was that calcium that is positively charged maybe could be taken out too. And so this fellow, Norman Clark, has a brainstorm and starts giving EDTA intravenously to patients who were having severe coronary pains. Lo and behold, the majority of the patients demonstrated an improvement in their pain. Then that started spreading a little bit. Then there were a few negative reports saying, well, it doesn't really work. And somehow in the 70s, it became the province of alternative medicine, and conventional cardiology, my people, turned away from it.
So that was in the 1970s.
70s and here, around 80s, yeah.
And here there were this empirical evidence that it was actually working for these heart patients who were experiencing this pain.
And the other part that made me curious is that if you look at this treatment, if it's really worthless, it's been going on since 1956, was the first publication by Norman Clark. We're talking 68 years now. It's been a while.
Now,
so it seems to have legs.
Was Norman Clark a conventional cardiologist?
He was a conventional practitioner. In 56, there was no clear who was a cardiologist and who isn't.
I see.
This is before boards.
Okay, yeah. So in these specialties. All right. Well, you know, we're going to get to the trial, but I think it's a good time to take a break on today's topical currents. We're also going to enlist your feedback if you've had chelation therapy or if you have heart disease and wonder if you're a candidate for it, or if you have a loved one or friend who benefited from it, or you just have questions for Dr. Hervasio Lamas. You can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Dr. Hervasio Lamas, Chairman of Medicine and the Chief of the Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Hospital, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents Monday edition. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Dr. Hervasio Lamas. He's the Chairman of Medicine and the Chief of the Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center. And he was the study chair of the trial to assess chelation therapy. And we're going to get to that study now. Okay, it's called TACT, and we'll use the acronym.
Please. The acronym was carefully selected.
Okay. Trial to assess chelation therapy. It was a 10-year study. Explain the origins of the study, doctor.
Well, in 1999, so this is almost in prehistory, a patient walked into my office, and I remember him well because he was somewhat disheveled. He looked a little bit like Lieutenant Columbo.
Okay.
And he said he wanted to have chelation therapy. And what did I think about it? And I gave my stock answer, which was, you know, this is junk science. Take the medicines that I'm prescribing. And then it occurred to me that I was being somewhat flip, and that instead of being scientific and really looking into it, I was giving an answer that I had been taught or that I had absorbed. When I looked into it, I found that I did not have the data, hard scientific data, to tell him that it was junk. And the information that would suggest that it wasn't also was not really compelling. It was a single case report, case series, just reports. And that doesn't convince. And that, so at that point, I decided that this question could be answered with a clinical trial.
So did something change within you? I mean, was there some internal something that happened within you, or just what you just said, that you realized the data wasn't there to support what you were saying?
I've been a clinical trialist since my cardiology training, and I get ideas, and then I decide that they can be answered, and sometimes I become obsessed. And any clinical trial requires obsession, because you have to find many millions of dollars. You have to find hundreds of colleagues that will share your obsession. And then you have to be able to live by whatever answer you come up with.
Good or bad, right or wrong? Yes or no?
There is no answer that is good or bad.
Okay.
They're just answers.
Okay. So who were the other researchers? Who conducted the study? And tell us about that.
So the way that it works is that you have the idea, and then you need a lot of infrastructure. So part of the infrastructure is that you have to have some biostatisticians to help you collect the data and process it. You need clinical sites where the patients will be enrolled. In TACT, we had 134 clinical sites throughout the U.S. and Canada.
And Canada.
Among those, for example, were Hopkins, Mayo Clinic, several other well-known universities. You have to have somebody who is completely objective review the events, somebody who doesn't know what patients have been assigned to. And that event adjudication actually was located at Harvard. My statisticians, who were the ones who knew what the code was, who was on placebo, who was on the real stuff. So they had real-time knowledge of what was going on. They were at Duke. I kept them physically separate. And so then, of course, the gasoline, the fuel that keeps the thing going, is that you need money. And that money came from the National Institutes of Health. That came from the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, $15 million from them, and $15 million from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. And I can tell you, no one else would ever have funded a trial like this, because everything in it is generic. There is no pharmaceutical involvement, 100% generic, zero pharmaceutical involvement, and that's why we need an NIH.
Wow. So you were kind of, it's amazing that they agreed to do it. Why did they?
That's also an interesting question. And they did it because of, I mentioned before, the chelation seemed to have legs. There was pressure from patients to their congressman. Why can't I get this treatment? Or so-and-so avoided a bypass by doing chelation therapy, and I can't get it paid, or I can't get it done. So there was some congressional pressure on NIH to get this done. But at the end of it all, NIH, it's really a really good group of scientists. And they felt, as I did on that in that summer in 1999, look here, this is a question that can be approached with a clinical trial. Let's get it done. Let's settle it. And I would have bet you dollars to donuts that it was going to be a negative study.
And you were wrong.
And I was wrong. And I've reviewed in my mind the trials that I've done, and I'm half right, half wrong, which is why you do research.
Which is pretty good. That's a pretty good record. So how was it determined that the chelation would be used in conjunction with these high doses of vitamins and minerals, oral vitamins and minerals?
So the chelation therapy are intravenous infusions. So they go into a vein in the arm, and it's very demanding. The intravenous infusion has not only EDTA, but it also has 7 grams of vitamin C. That's a lot of vitamin C in your vein. Some magnesium, other electrolytes, some B vitamins, a little heparin. This is a mix that chelation practitioners came up with empirically over the course of decades. And then I went to meet a local chelation practitioner to find out what they really did. And in fact, they gave somewhere between 20 and 50 infusions. And they also gave high doses of oral multivitamins and multiminerals. And so that, in clinical trial speak, it would be called a confounder, because we wouldn't be able to sort of control what people were taking. So we did really 2 trials within one: intravenous infusions that were active versus a saltwater placebo, and oral vitamins versus an oral placebo. So you can imagine that there are 4 groups, in fact.
Okay.
Active-active and placebo-placebo are the 2 extremes.
Right.
The others just have 1 active therapy and 1 placebo therapy.
Now, how did you choose the participants? How did they qualify? What did they have to – what were the qualifications?
Well, in order to qualify for the study, we needed patients who had had a prior heart attack, so they needed to have coronary risk. So age at least 50, a prior heart attack, and they needed to be able to excrete the chelation solution in whatever was being chelated, so they needed relatively good kidney function.
I see. Okay. We have lots of calls. I'm going to ask you just to stand by and just be a little patient, and we will get to you. I just want to do some more background with Dr. Lamas first before we take our calls. So let's look at the results of the study. Are we ready to go there?
I love the results of the study. I'm still shocked.
Okay, first, what does it mean when you say it's a double-blind study?
Double-blind means that neither the physician delivering the infusion nor the patient receiving the infusion knows if that infusion is active or if it is placebo.
Okay. All right.
Placebo infusion, remember, was essentially salt water, and the other one had EDTA, vitamin C, all sorts of stuff in it.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the results.
So we enrolled our first patient in September of 2003, and we unblinded in August of 2012. So for 9 years, I was pushing this study along without any idea
of the outcome.
Exactly. The outcome was known by an external board called the Data Safety Monitoring Board, and by a few, 3 Duke statisticians, everybody sworn to secrecy, and everybody good poker players. So we get into a room in August of 2012. The data books are handed out. We all go to the bottom line, and the study's positive. And the study's positive in the following way. In patients who are receiving EDTA chelation plus high doses of vitamins, compared to those that are receiving placebo, there is a 26% reduction in cardiac events. Cardiac events are dying, having a stroke, another heart attack, bypasses, being hospitalized, etc.
Okay.
And mind you, all of the patients are receiving our standard drugs. They're on statins. They're on beta blockers. They're on ACE inhibitors. They're receiving an aspirin. They're on Plavix. They're receiving the standard stuff. So this is add-on therapy. Mm-hmm. It's not alternative therapy. It is add-on therapy.
So they stayed on their regimen, whatever
Absolutely.
It was, in addition to getting...
And we insisted, because it would be unethical to have patients not take something that has been demonstrated by the same clinical trials methodology to be efficacious.
Right.
So that was a 26% reduction. So then we flip it around and say, okay, well, let's look at these subgroups that are ultra high risk. We looked at patients with diabetes. In diabetes, leaving aside the oral vitamin part, EDTA chelation versus placebo is a 41% reduction in events.
41% without the vitamins?
Not even including the vitamins.
Okay.
If you throw in the vitamins, you're now at about 50% reduction in events. Mm. It's staggering.
So what does happen when data shakes a doctor's beliefs? What happened?
Well, I can give you it's been an evolution. So the initial reception to this was really not a positive reception because people don't really like their long-held beliefs shattered. So when I presented the study initially, it was greeted with disbelief and perhaps a little unfriendliness. I have, and my team has subsequently been publishing analyses, and we've been lecturing, and we have been trying to educate our cardiologists. And consequently, at this point, there is a lot of interest. I've lectured at Columbia. I've lectured at Harvard. Neither tomatoes nor shoes flew.
That's encouraging. So, but originally when you submitted these results, you said they were rejected.
Yes, the first time we submitted them, they were rejected. And the underlying theme was we really are not publishing on chelation because everybody knows it doesn't work. You must have done something wrong. We then went to a different journal. And again, they had the same reservation, but they were curious enough to put their reservations down and allow us to answer. And in fact, the response was close to 100 pages from our part, going through every single problem that they felt was going on. The study was published. The editors, in fact, felt compelled to write an editorial explaining why they had published it. Because it was so controversial.
You mean they had to almost apologize, like do a disclaimer or...
It wasn't quite a disclaimer. It was, understand us. This is why we did it. It was very interesting. I had never really seen that, nor had I suspected I'd be involved in it.
Before we get to the calls, and I want to go much more into detail here, but if metal toxins can cause heart disease, can chelation prevent it from developing in the first place? Are there preventative aspects of it for somebody who has a history of heart disease?
Well, this is interesting, and this is, of course, where I would get myself in trouble. But it seems logical that if there is, metals, we're talking about metal pollutants that
right.
we're picking up from our
environment,
because the environment is fairly polluted. So if metal pollutants can cause coronary disease or increase it in individuals who already have established coronary disease, it is a very reasonable question to ask, shouldn't we be getting all our metal out before we develop coronary disease?
Right.
But I have to say that is something I did not study, and so I cannot give you a well-formed opinion.
Are you going to?
Give you an opinion?
No, study it.
The problem with that really is that patients who have not had a heart attack, they're practical problems. Trying to prevent that initial heart attack would require maybe 50,000 patients.
Right.
So it's a matter of dollars and cents.
Let's take some calls. We're speaking with Dr. Gervasio Lamas. He is the chief. Let me get to my paper. He's the chairman of medicine and the chief of Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center. And we have lots of calls. We're going to start with the first one, which is Martin in Pembroke Pines. Welcome, Martin. You're on Topical Currents.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Dr. Lamas, I heard about chelation therapy in the 70s when I was told I had high mercury levels in my body. And as a result of a hair test at a nutritional center. I never followed it up, but I did know someone who underwent chelation, and the results were remarkable. He went from being almost totally immobile to dancing disco. how available is it today? And will it eventually be covered by medical insurance?
I think, Martin, that these are really important questions that you ask. In terms of its availability, there are organizations of chelating physicians that you can, from which you can get a chelation practitioner to see you. Will it one day be covered? I hope that for the indication that I looked at, which is in patients who've had a prior heart attack, that one day that will be covered and it may become standard treatment. But quite honestly, I think that more scientific work is going to have to be done in order to kind of move the needle in that direction.
Well, let me ask you this. I have a girlfriend who's had half a lung removed and several stents put in her arteries. Would it be advisable for her to seek out chelation?
Well, in abstract, it's always very difficult for a physician to give medical advice. And what I would say is, consult your doctor. But
I ran into the same thing that you ran into when I questioned it 40 years ago.
What I would suggest is that you can look up my name. And my articles are all downloadable. I've made sure that every single one of them can be downloaded free of charge.
Has anything been observed regarding Alzheimer's or Parkinson's?
There are definitely reports in the chelation literature and also in the experimental literature about the involvement of metals with Alzheimer's.
Right.
It's not something that has been studied in a careful way with large-scale trials, the way that I studied coronary disease.
Well, okay, what would your guess be?
I don't think he's going to take a guess. But thank you, Martin, for calling. You asked some good questions.
You're welcome. All right.
Thank you, sir.
And I do want to say that we are not giving any specific medical advice on the program today. We're just talking about Dr. Hervasio Lamas's study about chelation therapy, to assess
chelation therapy, because it required a lot of tact to put this together.
Yes. Very good. Very good. Okay, we're going to go to Dan in Hialeah. Hi, Dan. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lamas, my father had a hip replacement, and so my question is twofold. He's got elevated levels of cobalt, and some people also get elevated levels of chromium, so number one, I wanted to ask if those two things can cause heart disease. And number two, whether they can or whether they can't, could chelation therapy be used to remove chromium and or cobalt from the body?
That's a very interesting and very timely question. There have been some metal-on-metal hips that were developed and then placed, which began to deteriorate and then lead to a leaking of cobalt and chromium. Cobalt, for sure, is quite toxic to the heart. There was a New England Journal of Medicine article on this early this year. It's called, I can't remember the name now, but it was actually a woman who ended up having a heart transplant because her heart was destroyed by cobalt. And they figured it out when the transplant was also now becoming destroyed. It was called Missing Parts of the History. And eventually she had her hip re-replaced, and the cobalt levels went down, and her transplanted heart then recovered. So I think that this is something you need to look at with your orthopedist as well as with your cardiologist. But there is a chance that cobalt will damage the heart, and that has been reported.
And can chelation therapy chelation
can take out cobalt, but not if you still have that hip in. Because
can
that
also
hip
pick
is a
out chromium?
It's a huge source, and you can also pick out chromium. Yes.
Wow! Thank you so much, Doc.
Okay, thank you, Dan. And let's move on to Jane in Delray Beach. Welcome, Jane.
Oh, hi! Thanks for taking my call. I congratulate the doctor for finally coming over to this science. We have a lot of heart disease in my family, so, going back 30 years ago, I started doing this research, and I found out about it just from listening to probably the best health show in the nation, the Ari Mel Show in New York City on WBAI. And, there have been lots of doctors who've written books on this, and whenever I've mentioned this to one of my mother's cardiologists in these large groups, They don't want to hear a thing. I mean, there are other things that I've mentioned to my dentist about mercury amalgam filling. They don't want to hear it. It's ridiculous, and this is a perfect example of the incestuous relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and medical school. Because they are taught, and I'm sorry to say, you know, I know you're a doctor, and I shouldn't be preaching, but doctors should get the heck away from listening to the pharmaceutical industry telling them what drugs I should take, you know, because they would be drugging me to death with all my back pain right now, you know.
Okay.
It's horrible. And this is just amazing that he's done, this doctor's done this peer-reviewed study, when other doctors have been saying, read my evidence, why haven't, you know, why aren't you taking this seriously? The patent ran out on chelation therapy back in the 50s. That is the main reason why it was never pursued, because nobody can make any money on it. And the American government is in bed with pharmaceutical. FDA approves all kinds of crap drugs.
Jane, do you want to let the doctor comment?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Lamas.
First of all, I think that we're dealing with a human quality, which is that people do not like very much to hear that their established beliefs have been challenged. Secondly, with the comment regarding the government, please remember that this study was funded by the government. It was funded by the National Institutes of Health, and no one else could have done that. And I do think that what you're encountering is a microcosm of the closed-mindedness that all physicians have, and in fact, all of us have. We all have our biases, and sometimes it's very difficult to accept that there are data that challenge our bias.
Okay, Jane, we hope that answers your question. Are there risks involved with this, or side effects, or is it completely safe? What are the statistics there?
That's also quite interesting, because chelation with disodium EDTA, which is the kind that we use, was thought to be less safe. The FDA actually reported, and you can find this in an FDA website, deaths that had been reported to them over a 36-year period, and there were 11 deaths, which, although it is unfortunate, it is still a relatively small mm-hmm. number, given that maybe millions of people used it, or maybe a million used it.
Right.
Within our study is really the only time that there has been a real safety analysis of this. And we gave 55,222 infusions to our 1,708 patients. So we actually were targeting 40 infusions per patient. We had 65% of them finished all 40, and 76% finished all 30. So these people, and again, if somebody asks you to be in a clinical trial, think about it carefully before you say no. These people were saints. Without them, we could have not had these results. So we compared placebo and the active treatment in terms of an extensive series of serious side effects. They were pretty identical.
Really?
Yeah, pretty identical. It's pretty safe.
What about the poor people who were on the placebos that didn't get the benefits? Will they go? Are they available? Can they go now get in chelation therapy?
Well, this is it leaves them in a bit of an orphan state. We've made available the information as to what people were receiving.
Right.
Yet we're not providing clinical chelation therapy yet. I'm hopeful that Mount Sinai will be one of the first places that does so. And so it leaves them looking for somebody who will do their chelation therapy.
We have an emailer. It's a little bit, let's see if I can, this is Joyce. The question really is stents versus chelation. She says, her cardiologist saw a blockage during her husband's stress test, wants him to get a CT scan, then follow with angio to place stents, 90% chance he'll need them. Her husband has no symptoms of angina. However, the fatigue due to anemia, he'll need 2 units of iron transfusion. Concerned that depending on the specialist, they seem to not see any issue only through the prism of expertise. Our cardiologist told me, my husband, he's not anemic. I'd like to try to reverse if possible by improved diet and exercise. Do you think a blockage is reversible with lifestyle changes? What about the financial incentive regarding stents? Is chelation therapy covered by insurance?
So going backwards, chelation therapy is covered by insurance only if your physician can demonstrate that you have a metal toxicity, specifically lead toxicity. So generally it is not. Question that you need to be answering for your husband, or he needs to answer, is does he really need anything done if he feels fine? These are always questions to ask your physician when you feel fine and a procedure is recommended. Should he get chelation instead of a stent? We never studied that. In fact, 83% of our patients in our trial had already had either a stent or had had coronary bypass. So they were already, most of them, revascularized. Mm. Remember, this was not alternative treatment. It was add-on treatment.
Right. All right. We do need to take another break. Dottie and Paula, stay there, and we'll also invite your calls, 1-800-743-9576. We have about 15 minutes left in the program, or close to it. We're speaking with Dr. Gervasio Lamas. He's the chairman of medicine, chief of the Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center, and the study chair of the trial to assess chelation therapy. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Dr. Gervasio Lamas. He is the chairman of medicine and the chief of Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center. And he was the study chair of the trial to assess chelation therapy, which had pretty remarkable results. And we're going to go right back to the phones and speak to Dottie in Delray. Welcome, Dottie.
My question to the doctor is, my grandmother and my grandfather both had chelation, and years later they both developed temporal arteritis. And temporal arteritis, from what I understand, is not common. And we were wondering if in your studies or whatever, that you think that it's possible that a side effect could be something like temporal arteritis.
That's a very good question. We looked very carefully at side effects and other illnesses that developed in our group. As I said, we gave 55,222 infusions, half of which were placebo. We did not detect any increase in immunological type illnesses in either of the two groups.
Thank you.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Thank you, Donnie. And we'll go to Paula in Dania. Hi, Paula.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I've been working on being brief. Here's the question. Can chelation therapy help someone who has had multiple MRIs with either iodine or the rare earth mineral gadolinium? Can that help cleanse the body of that? And are those things so horribly bad in you if they're called chelated before they're injected? And also, how are the infusions excreted? Do the excretions show how much metal and such has come out of you?
Let me answer the MRI question first. The contrast that is used in MRI is a rare earth metal called gadolinium.
Right.
And gadolinium, if it is kind of loose in the body, is actually fairly toxic. So it's injected in a chelated form, so with another molecule that is kind of its chaperone, so that it does the contrast, but then the body excretes it. Tiny little bit of gadolinium can stay behind. And there are patients who have complained of symptoms after after a contrast MRI or after several contrast MRIs. And in fact, I do know of chelation practitioners who are doing chelation therapy for gadolinium. It does come out, but very, very slowly. The other part of your question was?
After the infusions are excreted, I guess in urine, is it measurable?
Yes, it is measurable, in fact. We unfortunately did not do that in our clinical trial because even though $30 million sounds like a lot, we were going for 10 years giving all these infusions, et cetera. And so we weren't funded to try to figure out the mechanics of how this study was working. So, it is detectable in the urine. And if you undergo this, I would encourage you to try to understand what is coming out.
Well, it's all very interesting because in the 70s, I remember everybody poo-pooing the idea, friends who were raving about it.
Yeah.
Seems like a long time ago.
Okay, Paula. Well, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Arnie in Boynton Beach. Hi, Arnie.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. If you have a history of heart disease, should you be doing some kind of test to determine the metals in your system before you see whether you're a candidate for chelation?
That's a great question also, and you have to understand that in our clinical trial, we did not check for metals, so that the connection between the metals and the improvement that we saw really has to be accepted as a hypothesis. So that's, I think, the leading theory as to why it worked. Can I tell you for sure that somebody who has more metals is going to get more benefit than somebody who has fewer metals? No, absolutely not. So that's it's a good question, but it's one that I hope the future studies are going to answer. I can't answer that right now.
And can we assume that all of us have some level of metals in our bodily system?
I think that unless you have been living in a plastic bubble, you can assume that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Arnie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Virgil.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Virgil, we're getting a little short on time, so if you could keep it brief in Jupiter.
Hi, yes. I was just wondering if the study had shown any improvement in ejection fraction or heart function after the administration of the chelation therapy.
We did not look at ejection fraction. We really looked at recurrent heart attacks, deaths, stents, bypasses, strokes, sort of clinical endpoints, not physiologic or imaging endpoints.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay,
you're welcome,
thank
sir.
You. And also, we'll ask you to keep it brief. Maria in Miami.
Hi, my name is Marina Stassi. I'm calling to find out any benefits or risk to have chelation in autistic children.
You know, we really did not study autistic children. It has been highly controversial. And this is an area where, in general, it is not thought to be beneficial.
Okay, Maria, thank you very much. So, Dr. Lamas, I'd like to know, for your patients, are you still just practicing conventional cardiology at this time?
Well, I am becoming really progressively uncomfortable in the sense that when I see a patient who would have been a TACT-eligible patient,
mm-hmm.
and I give them their statin, maybe they have a catheterization plus or minus a stent. They're doing well. Maybe they have diabetes. Am I doing everything, doctor, that I can for my condition? I'm getting nervous because the answer, I can't say no. You don't have to do anything else. Mm. It's as if I had a guilty secret.
Right.
So I need to move from where I am as a conventional cardiologist and begin to move towards where the data are driving me or really have driven me.
And how will you do that? How will you make that move?
The way to implement that really is within the very conventional hospital and cardiovascular unit that we have at Mount Sinai Medical Center, where we do great cardiac surgery, We have the number one heart attack survival rate in Florida. But we need to do this and bring it into the mainstream. And that's what I am, one of the various activities that I am trying to implement.
Are there still great obstacles to doing that?
Well, everybody who hears the word chelation therapy, immediately they get nervous. So the difference is, of course, now I have the data. I say, okay, I understand you're nervous. Let's go over the three scientific papers, the voluminous safety data. And, you know, by and by, people are reasonable. They are good scientists, and they work out.
Is there a website that we can put on our website for the result studies,
I can give you the link to each one of those papers.
Okay.
And they are downloadable. We made sure that they would be downloadable for free.
Okay, so we will get those links and we will put them on our website. Well, it's been a very interesting hour. I'm sorry I couldn't get to Gail and Camille in a couple of emails, but we're out of time. Dr. Gervasio Lamas is the chairman of medicine and the chief of the Columbia University Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center, and he was the study chair for the trial to assess chelation therapy sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, and he's authored over 300 scientific publications and probably more to come. And it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Bonnie, thank you. It's been an honor.
And that is our show for today. We thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives with technical direction and a production assistance from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information on our Facebook page, facebook.com/topicalcurrents. On tomorrow's Topical Currents, we'll visit with John Quick. He's the president of the Friends of the Miami-Dade Public Library, and discuss ways we can help preserve our libraries. With the budget cuts in recent years, hours have been reduced, there have been staff cutbacks, programs have been eliminated, and new books are not purchased. An important note here, in anticipation of tomorrow's program on the importance of libraries in our community, please visit our website at WLRN.org and share your views and your experiences with and at the library. Again, that's WLRN.org. Or you can tweet us, that's at Topical Currents, or you can go to our Facebook page, that's facebook.com/topicalcurrents, and share your views on why you love the library and why they need to be saved and the budget restored. Bonnie Berman joining you and sending best wishes to Joseph Cooper for his speedy recovery and hoping your day is a great one. Thank you, Dr. Gervasio Lamas, for your time today. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.